Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome aboard the Chatbus, the podcast miniseries that talks with fellow travellers through the forest of films of one of the world's greatest animation studios, Studio Ghibli. I'm Michael Leader.
And I'm Jake Cunningham, and I've got my bus pass.
So join us on our quest into the glorious world of Ghibli. Jake, you're here for a second round on the Chatbus.
Oh yeah, you know me. I might get travel sick on regular buses, but the chat bus, I'll always sit on the front. Although I recently got told that actually, if you do suffer from travel sickness, sitting next to the wheel, so if you find look at the wheelbase and sit closest to where the wheels are, there's less wiggle, and so sit next to the wheel if you get sick. Which is not the point of advice that I expected this podcast to kick off with. But there you go. You learn something new from all of these episodes, don't you?
Absolutely. Gosh, we're dealing out some real home truths here, some tips for life. Who are we talking to this week, Jake?
So in this episode, we've got Kenneth Ledeck here and Jess Nichols from Sun Creature Studio, who have just recently made history, have they not?
They absolutely have. So they are the studio behind the animated documentary Flea, which was nominated for 3 Oscars this year, making history, as you said, Jake, nominations in 3 categories, including Best Animated Feature, Best Documentary, and Best Foreign Language Film.
Yes, yes, such a good film. And it's one of those really nice ones where it's had a really long cinematic life already, and people have just been picking it up, and it's getting bigger and bigger, a bit like Drive My Car as well. So this film premiered at Sundance 2021, and then you've had Nikolai Coster-Waldau, aka Jamie Lannister from Game of Thrones, and Riz Ahmed come on as executive producers. They've lent their voices to a dub, and all of this like hype has gradually kind of built across the year and then come to now. And this is a really nice surprise that a grown-up piece of animation really has become a bit of a breakout hit and has found audiences who maybe wouldn't normally be watching documentary or wouldn't normally be watching animation.
Yeah, it's always a treat for us when people who don't normally watch animation are watching animated films. If you haven't had a chance to see Flea yet, come strongly recommended from us at Ghibli Tech. Just let's have a quick synopsis before we dive in, because this is something a bit different from the usual for us. Flea tells the story of Amin Nawabi as he grapples with a painful secret he has kept hidden for 20 years, one that threatens to derail the life he has built for himself and his soon-to-be husband. Recounted mostly through animation to director Jonas Puhr Rasmussen, he tells for the first time the story of his extraordinary journey as a child refugee from Afghanistan. So this collision of animation, documentary, really one of a kind, I think, Jake.
Yes, and that's exactly why we wanted to talk to the guests that we've got today, because of how varied the style of this film is. So within those different realms of memory that it exists in. So in Amin's present day, in his childhood, and then he's in these kind of fragmented traumatic memories that are a bit looser. You've got a lot of different approaches to animation. And so we've got the animation director, Kenneth, and the art director, Jess, to explore more about the visual identity of Flea. and the character of Amin.
Absolutely. They were very patient answering our nerdy, naive questions. Because I guess week in, week out in this podcast, we talk about backgrounds, talk about animation. We've quoted filmmakers where they talk about how the individual animators can almost be actors when creating their characters through a scene. Also, we've mentioned Ghibli backgrounds, Ghibli clouds, Ghibli skies in the past. So it's amazing to talk to people whose actual job is doing that. And thank you to them for being so patient. So there is a lot of Ghibli, actually, more than you think, maybe, in this conversation.
Yes. Well, and there's a lot of Ghibli happening at Sun Creature, because if you go on YouTube and look for a lovely advert for Visit Oregon, the American state, then it is maybe the biggest Ghibli love letter since Mary and the Witch's Flower. It's just a lovely, lovely Miyazaki recreation. But imagine all of everything that you love about Ghibli and Japan and the look of a Miyazaki film, but transport it not from Japan or not from Wales, but all the way to Portland, Oregon, and imagine what that might look like. And it is very, very lovely. And so we do get into a bit of there how you go about recreating the look of a Miyazaki film too.
Mm-hmm. So let's listen to our conversation with Kenneth and Jess. Kenneth, Jess, thank you so much for joining us. It's such a pleasure. Congratulations on Flea. We'll be talking about that shortly. But we love to set off all these conversations with Studio Ghibli, which, of course, is in the title of our podcast. And we like to ask our guests, what was your first experience with Ghibli? Who wants to take that question first out of the two of you?
I don't really remember the first time I watched it. I think it was like growing up in, like, I'm Australian originally, but I spent a lot of my teen years in the UK. I remember my friend had her dad was part of an animation school in High Wycombe at some point. So I think he introduced us when I was pretty young, but I think I really remember getting into it when I was about, I think I must've been late teens, early 20s. And I was studying in Edinburgh, and I had a really bad breakup. I think I downloaded the entire filmography and just went through. And I think I remember watching Pompoko and being like, this is amazing. And I don't know what it says about me that my like breakup film is a film about raccoon testicles, but it's fine. Yeah. And then it stuck.
Yeah, you just needed out those testicles, and then it all clicked into place.
Exactly.
It's an ocean of transforming testicles, and then like over.
I'm done. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. No, but I promptly dropped out of uni and went to study animation instead. So.
Inspired by Pompoko, etc., or?
I think so. I think it was a mix of that and some I also watched Waltz with Bashir around the same time, and uh-huh. a couple of other like more not like A-list films, I guess. And then yeah, that started a downhill slope.
And Kenneth, how about you? What was your first taste of Ghibli?
I remember that I think I came across it just by accident on the Danish TV. Where they were showing Totoro, my neighbor Totoro, but I think like back then they, because it's for kids, then they divided it up into parts. Wow. Which is blasphemy, but they had done that, so I probably watched like the part 2 or 3 or something like that. They were just showing it like random times, but as a kid I just remember being like, whoa, what is this, even though I could not follow the story at all, because you jump into the middle of it.
I suppose there's not really much of a story there anyway, so if there was one of theirs that you were going to turn into chapters, that's probably the one that's going to work.
Yeah, it's probably not the worst. I still remember being like caught by the mood of it, and that it was just, it felt special, like there was something different about it compared to all the other like more Disney style mm-hmm. things I've seen back then. There was just that focus on the mood and those little moments where you just follow a character looking at stuff and you're like, what's going on? So that was my sort of first encounter with the Miyazaki-san. But I think the proper like full film watching is a little blasphemous as well. But I watched what's it called, the Princess Mononoke, mm-hmm. on YouTube, on that little, like, on my shitty computer in my room as a kid. But even, like, to the testament of that film, even on that little, like, what do you call it, square on my screen, mm-hmm. I was still just, like, poof, like, blown away by it. And then years later at animation school, I saw it in cinema, and I was like, oh, okay, that's how you're supposed to watch it. It's pretty crazy. Yeah.
Wow, we're already off to such a blasphemous start, as you said.
I feel totally vindicated for, like, all the people that send mean tweets saying, I can't believe he watched Spirited Away on a train, which I did do, but, you know, at least it was full screen.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Then I'm setting the lowest standards, it seems.
Was it common for anime like that to be on telly then, at that time?
Not in Denmark, it was pretty rare. I think we had Pokemon and we had Dragon Ball. And they were just, like, screening those episodes, like, in random, I remember. So you would just, like, suddenly be in Dragon Ball where he's fighting with Frieza, and then you would jump back to him as being a kid, like, the day after that. It seems like they had no, like, they didn't really care about the storyline. Mm-hmm. And then I had, like, then there was a few times where they would pick up Totoro, or I even remember there's an anime called Blue Submarine or something like that, that they would also divide into parts for some reason and then put up there.
And when you get into actually making animation, is there a bit of a Wizard of Oz moment where the curtain's drawn back and you can see what's making that magic? Because I think when we talk to people a lot about Ghibli, it's like, oh, I watched it when I was young and it was just so different and it wasn't what Disney was making, but I can't quite put my finger on it. Once you've gone into the careers that you've got into, are you able to discern more what that magic is?
That's a good question. Maybe you could start this time, Kat.
I feel like I'm almost like just throwing at you, just like, you start.
I'll see it in your eyes.
Yeah. The doubt and insecurity. I think, I mean, technique-wise, you of course learn how to animate and you learn how to draw it and you know how, like, our background is made and stuff. But I actually think, and this is probably perfect for a Ghibli podcast, but I actually think the Ghibli films still keep that kind of magic for me when I watch it, because it's so much about, like, the good old craft in a way and how things are drawn, so that you still, like, beautiful paintings where you can still get that wow effect as an artist, because at least I don't see, like, the cheats or, like, the, oh, they used that Photoshop brush for this and that, or they use this and this for, or they just copied a lot of drawings around to make it fake and movement or something. So the craft can still wow me. And then it's also just so much about, again, the mood and the story is what dictates how they're doing it. And then Miyazaki just has this sort of special sense of story and character that I think I at least forget the craft after like a few minutes, then I'm just into it, into the mood of it, and then it still has that sort of magical and nostalgic stemming, that's Danish mood. Yeah,
I think that's the crux of it. I think it's like there's so much about Ghibli that's or Ghibli or however, I don't know which one is the correct one, but I think it's more about, like, the filmmaking aspect of it. I think you see the craft and I guess it's like finding out, like, oh, that's how much I don't know. So it's like, yeah, seeing a master at work, I guess, like, in the same way that anyone could pick up a camera and you still go and see, like, a, I don't know, like a Coen Brothers film, and you're still like, how does that happen? Yeah. So it's, you can see technically, like, it's easy to kind of see how it's been done, but you still could never do it the same way.
I'm really intrigued by this, you know, binging the entire library, Jess. So what was it that, because I can't really binge stuff, telly and all that stuff, I don't have the stamina for it. But what pulled you through all that? What was it that was attracting you to keep going and watch all of them at once?
I mean, heartbreak was a lot of it.
it's quite a motivating force.
Yeah, exactly. I think it was also like, because I think it was, from what I remember, it was even in, like, year order when I got it. So I can't remember. I think at some point I was like, oh, I've seen Spirited Away a bunch of times, so I'll just start from the beginning and hope that they're all at that same caliber and just see how it goes. And I think it was just that, like, it's so different as well. Like, I think if you go back and watch a lot of the big studios in the States, like filmography, then you can see like this kind of creative direction that's really particular. And I think the Ghibli stuff really felt like it's a director's vision, I guess, every time. So I think in that way it was like, oh, this isn't so much about making money. This is about like someone's vision for what they want people to experience from a piece of art, I guess. So I think then you kind of just like, oh, well, thank God I have so many left. I'll just keep going.
And that's sort of been the journey of the podcast. When we started, Jake had really not seen, he'd seen Spirited Away on the train, as he said, but he was quite a novice and slowly revealing all these films to him. We didn't go chronologically, we sort of curated the journey. But what was great with Jake was seeing how, as he went through the library, he found his own favourites that maybe weren't the fan favourites. He was attracted to certain styles and filmmakers that maybe not what you'd expect. He became, you know, one of your favourites was Isao Takahata, you know. And suggested you get a sense of that when you were going through the library. You've already mentioned Pompoko, which is quite a deep cut immediately to mention, but what did you make of the other ones? Any other favourites?
Yeah, I think I remember there was an animation teacher who asked us in our first year at school, like, what is everyone's favourite animation film? And I remember saying Pompoko, and there were so many people in the class being like, nerd. So I think, I'm sure some, like, I was like, okay, guys, this is animation school, come on, like, up your game. It's not that, like, weird a selection, but yeah, no, I really like the Takahata stuff as well. Like, I think My Neighbor the Yamadas is also really good, and I guess I'm not as big a fan of, like, Kaguya, and I think there's something about that, like, the further in you get, the bigger the budgets get, and the less, like, restraint you have, so you become maybe, like, you're able to do maybe too much, is maybe how I feel about it. I think a lot of those earlier ones, also for like Miyazaki, I really like Nausicaa still, and some of the earlier stuff more than the newer ones, I think.
I love, there's so many common threads in these conversations, which I love, that come up so often, of Nausicaa being the best, so in theory that Miyazaki only ever got worse as a filmmaker, and that all the animators pick My Neighbors the Yamadas, like, particularly with people interested in animation, that film seems to go down so well. What is it about it?
It's a great character study. I don't know, have you seen it, Kenneth, that one?
Yes, it is also my favorite from him. I mean, from Isao. Yeah, because it just has, like, it's such good character study, as you say, and the animation is just.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
It's so good, and it's so, like, full of personality and these little, like, story segments. I think you're right. I totally agree with you, Jess, on the fact that I don't think he gets better with the higher the budget he has, like, because it's sort of, you get a little bit more distance from the actual story and the characters. And I think that the Neighbors Yamada, you're just like, you're in there. There's, like, it's so bare bones of what, like, the style is, that you just have to focus on what the the necessities are in terms of character and what is like the little stories and the little character interactions and all that stuff. And as an animator, that's just like, oh, no, no, no. You just eat that up.
I was gonna say, I think a lot of Takahata's ones are like that. Like, they all kind of feel like character studies in a way.
Oh yeah, they're just dreamy. I think that's what's so exciting to me about his form is like the confidence just to strip stuff away as well. Like Miyazaki is great as a great world builder, and those frames are so full of life and detail. And so I think that's what made me so excited about watching the Takahata films, is like in Only Yesterday, when the backgrounds just disappear and she flies up into the air, like those moments where it's just so focused on the emotion and the story and that connection rather than the look of the thing. He's so, so good at. So let's take the opportunity, because Michael and I are not animators. It'd be great to look at these films from a craft point of view. I suppose how these things actually get made. Jess, you've been lucky enough to go to the museum like we have as well, where they do kind of give you a little a look into the pipeline of these films. Is it scarily intimidating to look at that kind of stuff and see how a Ghibli film gets made?
I think the backgrounds, yeah. I mean, I'm like, Kenneth's definitely the animation side of this, like the partnership that we had on Flea. I'm more of like a background person, camera person. So I think there's that one room in the museum which has like all the original paintings just casually like pinned to the wall. It's not even behind any like, oh, perspex, you could shoot this and it's not gonna, yeah, they're just hanging out. It's insane. So I think there's something about that just makes me want to like, oh, just like put some, I don't know, some like aluminium foil or anything on it to like just protect it from these like heathen school children that are just running around. But I think the museum's also like a very idealized way of looking at it, I guess. Like all the production, all the stages of productions are so presented as like these little rooms in a house and things, so it looks really cozy, and I'm sure that it wasn't cozy all the time.
But Jess, I'd love to get your sense of what is so special about Ghibli's backgrounds and art direction, because we talk about Kazuo Oga, who's like one of he's the main art director on films like, and background artist on films like Totoro, and it's something we tend to focus on character design and animation, but the backgrounds are so important to that. And having an actual art director on the show, what is so special for you about Ghibli and that aspect of the craft?
I think you guys talked a little bit about like the whole stripping away unnecessary details and things. And I think it takes like a certain, there's a lot of egos, I guess, in like animation and art in general. And I think that it takes a certain special type of person to kind of be as amazing a painter as Kazuo Oga is, and then just like not paint everything. Like, you're still making room for the characters. Like, still the main focus is how to tell the story and what's important to the mood and the tone and all that. So I think it's the fact that it's that great filmmaking skill combined with that he's like had the time to both be an amazing painter, but also know the like story enough to know when to stop. And I mean, I have his book, and it's only in Japanese, and I have tried to read it so many times, and every time it's like a single little tear, because I just can't. But yeah, it's very impressive, just on like a technical level as well, I think.
Yeah, it makes, Jake and I were talking about this earlier, it makes me think of, we were talking with the curators of the Miyazaki exhibition in the Academy Museum in Los Angeles, and they had like a blue sky, Ghibli blue sky painted on the walls, and they had to get the guy who does the blue skies and clouds to come and advise about that. It's how important those landscapes and those backgrounds are to the Ghibli look and vibe and feel.
Yeah, I mean it's like a whole package really, right? The whole, like, there's not really any side of the filmmaking that lets it down, so you can talk about the animation, but then you've also got to mention all the other stuff alongside. It's just the masterwork.
Yeah, well, so on top of those backgrounds, we've got our characters. So, Kenneth, we'll turn to you there. So, thinking of the character movement that we might see in a Ghibli film, like looking at, I suppose, the stuff that we love about them, the way that they are so relaxing because they show us like the minute details of life as much as the big adventures. What's it about the movement here that we're seeing that kind of makes them unique?
I think it's a bit the same as what Jess says about the background stuff, is that it's really like less is more, that it really focuses on what is needed instead of just being like spectacular or to sort of like show a funny movement or make something look impressive. It always feels like it has some sort of root in the character in the moment. I really like, for example, when you the first time, who was the protagonist in Princess Mononoke? Yeah, Ashitaka. Yeah, when he meets the lady with the guns for the first time, she is sitting and preparing this. I think it's a letter or something like that, and she's sort of wrapping it all up and putting things aside. And it's not sort of like overdone or like really crazy stuff to show from sort of crazy world. It just shows her like meticulousness in terms of like preparing these things and packing it away. It also gives her, so it's really about her character, but it also grounds her as a person through the like the tools she is using. So it's a really nice sort of focus on the craft on the details in terms of what makes the characters, but not doing like overdoing it. And if you're comparing that scene with her putting like those tools away to the scene where in Ponyo where the mom is cooking noodles, where she's just sort of like sticking things in pots and pans and sort of making it a little bit more like wildly, it just really shows the character. And you can sort of relate to the feeling of putting these things aside because they just have that right sense of weight and material and all that. I think for me at least that feels pretty unique to Ghibli, that they set aside time in the film to focus on these things because it builds character and it builds the world and sort of connects everything together, I think, if that makes sense.
It makes complete sense. And when you're watching these films, it feels so organic and like it's just come out of the film. It doesn't feel like it's something that someone at some point has had to sit down and storyboard or find time and space for. So when you're actually making a piece of work yourself as an animation director, how do you find time to bring that to the characters in the film you're working on?
I think it's tough because it's like speaking about Flea, we didn't have the highest budget. So most of the time when the characters could stand still, then we preferred to do that because then it wasn't like it wouldn't run over the budget. But then again, having things like when Amin's sisters are like listening, or when they're listening to the older sister telling the story about their father, one of the sisters is sort of a bit older than than Amin and his older brother. So she's heard the story many times. So we showed that by her sort of sitting a bit more relaxed and her knees sort of like she's a bit fidgeting with her legs and stuff. She can't sit still because she's like, I've heard this story so many times. So she's a bit more sort of fidgety and moving around, where the others are like just in the story and just like big eyes and looking at the older sister. So we're still trying to find like moments like that to sort of say, okay, this character is like this, and she would probably think of she would be in this headspace during this moment. Things like that we're trying to sort of find moments for. But again, I think also for Flea, it was also a matter of like less is more, to not go cartoony on it.
And I suppose it's those little moments that are so key to actually getting to the emotional side of the characters as well. It's those little bits that make us see them as rounded humans or rounded monsters in a Ghibli film, whatever they might be. And I suppose that's a side of animation maybe people aren't considering, is just how much those little details are key in building up the entire story, right?
Yeah, but you can tell a lot from how giant cat monster would unwrap a pack of noodles, like if it's just like rah, and then eating it, or if it's more like meticulous and nice, then you put it all aside and pick up the little bits and pieces to fill out. Like you can use those moments to really explain a character a lot.
And with something like Flea, where so this is getting into this animated documentary aspect, because I suppose you're working from sound recordings and other materials. So when it comes to character design and then animation on top of that, what is the leeway you're giving yourself to create these characters and give them life as animated characters?
I mean, in terms of character design, then both then Jess and I were pretty sort of overlapping at that point. Mm-hmm. So Jess can also, you can just jump in here and add things as well. But we had footage of Amin during the interviews when he's on that couch, and we used that as a reference for those scenes. Mm-hmm. We didn't like trace it or rotoscope it, but we used it to sort of see like how does he wipe away his tears? How do you move when you're just lying down and with your eyes closed and talking about memory? Like you're not gesturing too much and all that stuff. So sort of reference to get a realism from it. But in terms of character design, we of course looked at how he sort of like places himself, or what do you call it, like how he his vibe, and sort of mm-hmm. try and get something similar to that, but still making sure that it's not like oh that's this guy if you see him on the street, he still needs to be anonymous. Mm-hmm. So I think we were using the reference as a way to sort of get the mood and the vibe from how they sort of presented themselves to stay authentic. As much as possible.
Yeah, I think Amin will always feel like the most authentic character in that film because we had more footage and sound recordings of him than by far anyone else. But I guess at some point you kind of have to just say, like, I guess there's all this issue with the representation and how do you, like, make a person feel real and stay true to who they are in reality. And at some point you just kind of have to say, like, oh, we need to make some sort of decision, I guess, and just ask people if it seems accurate. I think it's a lot about also, I mean, we talked a bit about all the small details that make up like how you perceive a character through the screen. And I think that when it comes to like real people, that stuff is equally important. And I think that when you see, like, sometimes when I this is hard because I feel like sometimes when you talk about Ghibli, it turns into like a Disney bash. But I feel like a lot of modern animation is like the characters feel kind of both overdeveloped and underdeveloped at the same time because you want them to communicate like a particular thing, like this character is like the sad one or something, and so that becomes like their entire character. So even though you've got this massive team that has like gone really deep into this character and like, oh, how is this, the fact that they're the sad one going to affect every part of their life, it's like, but that's not a real person. Like, sad people can also be happy sometimes, and like, I don't know, maybe that sad person like studied architecture and really liked it at some point or something. Like, I think you just gotta flesh it out a lot more, and then it helps, I think.
Yeah, I think it's because Jess, you mentioned Pompoko up top, made me think about that, because that film, even though it's depicting Tanuki, the Tanuki characters have almost three different styles they exist in throughout the film, either a very almost photorealistic animal style or a standing upright style or ultra cartoony style. And you know, Miyazaki would always have a very, you know, coherent, consistent design of his characters, but Takahata always loved to play with that and show us that there's no one way to draw a character. And I suppose with Flea, you've had to find, it's not as simple as having a slider, it's not a Photoshop plugin, but find the right sort of level for character design where it's empathetic, believable, authentic, but also so not so realistic that it's, you know, too connected to the reality of the story, I suppose.
Yeah, you also want to kind of abstract from it a little bit, I think, to allow people to have emotions about it. And I think that's where films like Grave of the Fireflies and stuff are such great reference, because it's such a good way to like digest hard topics as well, with all the stuff you can do in animation. And yeah, people always ask like, why is it an animated movie? And I understand that question, but I also kind of hate it, because it's a little bit like, well, you're kind of just picky between like a photo and a painting, I guess, and you can say a lot more like biased, I guess, but also you can just have more like mood and there's something that a painting can bring, I think, that it struggles in a photo to do the same.
Yeah, and on that point about anonymity as well that Michael, you're talking about, something that's fascinating about the way that Amin is drawn in Flea is that he's at no point is the animation used to make him cartoonish at all. It doesn't have that elasticity that people might expect of animation. His face is almost surprisingly unexpressive at points, but you'd expect him to be more animated, I guess. Is that a way of letting people into that experience and making them kind of feel more open towards it rather than forcing Amin's emotion on that moment. What was the approach there with his face?
I mean, it's a bit going back to what Jess said before, that some of, again, not to bash on Disney because it's just for a different audience, but in those films you want to like show very clearly what people are feeling at that moment. But in Flea, because it's we wanted it to really, like, authentic was one of our keywords, then it really needs to be a human. And humans are often like multifaceted about how they're feeling about a certain moment. And if I see something sad, I'm not going to stand on the street and be like, when I look at it, I'm probably just going to have a blank face and have things happening on internally instead. That's also like, I'm going a bit in circles, but maybe I think also having like a non-expression, but looking at something and you expect some sort of reaction, then that also forces the audience to really empathize with Amin and try to like think, I wonder what he's feeling now. I wonder if he's sad or maybe he's angry about this thing. What does he want to get back to his boyfriend, or what is he going to do? Instead of showing directly, he's feeling this now. Then we wanted to let it be more up for interpretation for the audience to really sit and sort of scan his face to see, to look for clues and look for what is he feeling at this moment. So that was sort of like the thought behind that acting choice of really going as subtle as possible, and trying to really avoid telling the audience like he feels this now, and really force them to try and empathize with him instead. If that makes sense.
Yeah,
there's different ways of doing it as well. Like we chose that route of like, which is a very real person thing to do, I think, like to not be an open book all the time. But I think, you know, when you look at like Ghibli films, you know, there's all this, that like kind of weird thing they do when the characters are shocked, or where the style kind of goes up and there's almost like a cat hair raised kind of moment. I think even that is like, there's different ways to interpret emotions like that rather than just being like, like if you want to look sad, you can look sad in like a multitude of different ways. And I think even if you kind of think about how a character would do that, then I think it helps portray them on screen.
Yeah. Going back to Takahata, he seems to be coming up quite a lot in this conversation. Another film where he plays with different styles depending on the scene is Only Yesterday, which is a film which has two time periods, one a sort of nostalgic memory and one the present day. And Flea is another one where it has this nested structure of stories and memory and the present day. And I wondered, both in terms of character design, animation, but then also art direction, how did you tackle that and think about representing those different time periods?
Oh, the time periods, that was a lot of research on that. I think part of that was like, both Kenneth and I come from like a more fiction background, I think. So coming in to a documentary, there was a lot of like, oh, we also want to do right by the people involved and things. So there was a lot of research, I guess. I think that Jonas, the director, having come from like a, he came from radio documentary before, but has also done some live action films, and he had a good sense of like how realistic he wanted to go. So I think the fact that we knew he wanted to go really realistic with the main style of the animation meant that, like, okay, well, now we have to go pretty realistic on like what that's portraying, I guess. And we made some decisions to try and like hide parts of the screen in like darkness and use like really extreme lighting so that we didn't just blow our budget insanely. But I guess like depicting different time periods and different locations was really a lot about what are those time periods and like what characterizes them, also in terms of like how both in terms of like set dressing, but also in terms of how you would shoot that kind of location, I guess. But I mean, that's just kind of the realistic style. Then there was like this also, yeah, as you mentioned, the other kind of graphical style, which was always kind of intended as this very separate thing. So that animation was actually kind of done by a small team that only worked on that. And that was developed tangentially, but still separate from the main body of work, so that it felt like it would also have a different visual cinematography, I guess. So even though like the character design at its base is still the same, it's still you use them in a slightly different way, I guess. And I think a lot of the reason behind that was to make it feel like a more subjective. So if it's one or two artists working on it, then it's like it's their voice, and you're not mixing like five different animators trying to make it feel like the same person's voice. It's just a bit easier to do if it's one guy sat by himself. So it was easier to kind of say like, this is Amin coming up with something that he either wasn't present for, or it was a really traumatic period in his life, so he doesn't remember it as clearly as he remembers the rest of the story, kind of thing. So that was done with like a very purposeful subjectivity in mind.
I think there was also a way in terms of how we storyboarded the different, those two different, like there's kind of like three different styles, you could say. There's like the documentary style where he is filming Amin, that is a bit more handheld, and we have a bit more of a shaky cam as if he's standing there filming Amin right at that moment. And then there's the clear memories for Amin where we go back in time. That is more sort of like standard cinema, where it was, where we always said like it needs to be filmed as if a camera could be there. So often the camera is sort of like eye level, because the cameraman would be able to stand there and film it, or woman. And then there's also, but that it also sort of forces the like cinematography to feel more realistic, because it the camera is placed where it could be realistically. You couldn't just have it sort of fly through a little hole and then open up into whatever. But then that was allowed in these more expressive moments. Then the camera can just do whatever and fly around, and things can morph because it becomes more subjective and emotional and stuff.
Yeah, I think the breadth of the style of it combined with that kind of emotional open book of Amin, and the way that we can read the story how we want it to read, there's a real depth to it. It's not perhaps just, I'll just join the Disney bashing for a moment, it's not putting the theme on the whiteboard and underlining it 10 times and saying this is the lesson of the story. It's really letting you like interpret the events as you want to, and I think that's something that we see in the Ghibli films as well. Like it's not about kind of clearly saying this is what you're meant to learn.
Totally. And I really want to like praise another film, like the Kiki's Delivery Service is actually it's probably my favorite one of all the Ghibli films. And I really think that one does that as well, where you follow Kiki and she sort of develops, but it's not like super obvious, like what she has learned. It's sort of very internal and very sort of like, I can watch it many times and still feel like, oh, I'm getting like learning new sides of her, and how the cat is suddenly less and less expressive, and how she has to stand on her own feet, and and nothing is sort of like overexpressed, even though it is a fairly cartoony film and sort of for kids in a way. I feel like it's really, really well balanced in terms of how much you're showing of her emotional journey, and how much you are left to interpret of like how it is to grow up and become mature. So that was at least a inspiration for me in how I wanted to direct a bit the acting and stuff.
Jess, just come back to something you just said, which resounded with something that we've talked about very recently on the podcast, about animators' hands, you know, being, you know, if you have a smaller team, you can really see an animator's subjectivity through a scene. We talked about Mamoru Hosoda on the podcast very recently, and he at one point reduced his team to the bare bones because he wanted his animators to be actors, is the way he described it. And Jake and I don't have an artistic bone in our bodies, although Jake is a better sketcher than I am. He can do a very good Totoro if you ever need to ask him for one. I can't. And we can't see it, but we hear animators talking about, oh, that's so clearly animated by this hand, by that hand. You can see the sort of bravura statements of certain animators when they're working on a sequence. And I wonder, could you expand on that a little bit, and what you mean by that? And Kenneth as well, what is this idea of animators as actors? Any comments on that?
I mean, I guess you like, everyone has their strengths in terms of, you know, like you have some people coming in because they're like, have always loved action sequences, and then they're really good at like that sort of thing. And I mean, that's like a very practical strength, I guess. But I mean, you can see it down to like the way, because of course we have all these guides of like, this is how you draw a character, this is how you draw a background. But you can kind of see people's personalities and in the way things are drawn, I guess. You know, like, I think there was one project at some point where I was like, oh my God, this person only draws, like, circles like they're drawn in, like, the Hercules Disney film. Because, and it turned out they just loved that film when they were a kid. So they, when they grew up, like, as teenagers, they just drew Hercules a lot. So I think, you know, you have, like, little kind of personal quirks in that way that kind of sneak in despite you trying to, like, beat it out of people to a certain extent. but I mean, everyone, I guess, also has this vision of, like, if you're given a scene, you have so many hours to work on it and stuff, and you kind of, you develop your own internal idea of what it should look like, even though you've been given this brief of like, this is what we want it to look like. You know, you don't have the finished thing in front of you, so you're still kind of interpreting a character in a moment, and especially with, like, listening to a voice and working out what's the emotions behind that at this point in time, and that's always a very subjective thing. So you can see if someone's, like, a romantic at heart and this kind of stuff just from the way people interpret briefs, I think.
So what's your quirk, Kenneth, that we can look out for? If there is one.
Better stay like a model, probably, so it's very fluid and organic is how I hide that.
But I don't know, I mean, you work more with animators than I do on, like, a day-to-day. I think it's more obvious with animators than it is with, like, background artists, right? I don't know if you have any anecdotes.
Yes, I mean, you can definitely see it in how they're even, like, drawing the characters, that they are, like, just different ways of how they're drawing the details. It comes across in their personal styles.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also ways that they depict movement. I remember in animation school when we had to do, like, animate, like, walks and learn how to draw walks, you could guess who animated it by how they walked, because you could see, like, oh, that's totally how this and that person walks. And then now the Pink Panther is walking like Miguel or like another person. So you can just see how, like, your own sort of natural sense and understanding of movement and acting and stuff comes across in how you depict it. And that is something we're trying to sort of cast animators. And even when we get animators in and we work with them, you sort of notice that, oh, this animator is really good at this thing, or this animator is really good at that subtle, like, little thing that we want to use in this scene. So in Flea, there was an animator who came from much more about, like, a Disney school. And he was really good at adding that little bit too much of, like, an overacting in a way. So it felt like sometimes it could sort of steer into, like, it felt like you're sort of forcing emotions out of you when you're combining it with the Flea style. But he was perfect with these sort of like telenovela scenes in Flea, where people sort of, like, overdramatic. So we gave him all those scenes and they just worked out perfectly with his style, because everything was just a bit too dramatic and a bit too sort of had too much flair, like, intentionally. Like, so like, that's a, for example, an example of how you would cast animators depending on what skills they have naturally.
And, like, an understanding. I think, like, there was one moment, I think, where there's, like, the two sisters on the bed and they're, like, reading a magazine or something. And I remember way back then, there was, like, there's something they did. And I just remember looking at them being like, oh, these, like, they're just, like, two teenage girls. They would never act like this or something. And then we ended up talking about, like, oh, okay, but then the other sister's going to, like, push it so that she was reading the page that before. So she wants to go back to that page, but her sister wants to turn the page and that sort of thing. So I think you can also see people's background. It's like, if you have a 45-year-old man animating teenage girls, it's not going to be the same if you have a teenage girl doing it.
So it's always good to have, like, multiple, like, review sessions with different people to sort of say a teenage girl would never do that.
And how are those sessions? There's one Ghibli session, I think it's actually after the film's been finished, it's in the From Up on Poppy Hill DVD extra, where Hayao Miyazaki goes out the front and then schools them all on the timing of walking. It must be quite brutal sometimes, some of those sessions.
It can definitely be. I remember, like, animation school being quite brutal, because you're trying so hard and then you're just getting bashed sometimes, because, like, oh, you don't know, like, the weight is wrong, and, like, oh, you poor little thing, let me show you. But I mean, on Flea, it was luckily not that harsh. And we usually had, like, the director and then me in a separate room to sort of go, oh, what are we going to do? to sort of look at it and see what it needs, and then you would forward that to the animator. But I think on higher budget shows or films, I do see that you bring every animator into a big room and just like commonly review, and I think that must be so tough if you're not the most confident person. I would hate it.
Especially with these massive budget films, because you spend like weeks on, like, I think, what was it, the average? I can't remember when this fact is from, but I remember hearing at some point that Pixar's average was like 6 seconds a week per animator, which sounds fairly realistic. And like our quotas on Flea, I can't remember exactly what they were, kind of, it was drastically different, I remember.
Yeah, it was like 15 seconds or something like that, if it's not more even.
Yeah, so I think you like, if you've worked for weeks on this one scene and then it just gets absolutely destroyed in front of people, then of course it can be like really draining. But I mean, like I said earlier, you have a lot of people who go into animation, it's a passion thing to do, right? So I think people can also put a lot of weight on their craft as like an expression of themselves. So if you review them really harshly, even if you're coming from a place of like, this is not about the you and the work, this is about like what is necessarily for the film, like in another setting. Like, as we said, like the Disney thing is just a totally different audience. Like that's going to be a different requirement than what is needed on like a Ghibli film or on Flea or any other type of film. But it can really like, you can see it in their faces. Yeah.
Well, Kenneth, am I right in thinking you did a bit of work with Cartoon Saloon as well? So for Song of the Sea. And so like in the grand international scheme of hand-drawn animation houses, they're a pretty big deal now. How would the Cartoon Saloon environment compare to the Sun Creature and Flea environment compared to what you see of the Pixar and Disney's out there?
I mean, when I worked on Song of the Sea, I wasn't there. I was in Vibor, in with the early days of Sun Creature Studio, when we were just like three people. and then I was just doing a bit of cleanup on it. So I can't really say how it was to be in a production in terms of their studio. But later in I went over to their studio to do a storyboard for Eddie of the Realms, a pilot they did. But like who in terms of like the like differences, yeah, that's a good question. I think they have a like very similar vibe in a way, in that they are like a fairly small still, so they still have you still feel pretty close to everyone there and feel like you can go up to anyone and talk to them. There's that sort of like master who walks in from the door into the room and then everyone's like ooh, and hide behind the desks or something like that. And that just creates a like a pretty safe environment where you feel like you can contribute with ideas and pitch suggestions without feeling like you're risking being fired. And I hope that's the same feeling as Sun Creature.
what's the game plan with Sun Creature? I mean, going on the site and seeing the portfolio, the sort of contract work with, you know, really high quality stuff. But do you have aspirations for features and everything in the future? What's to come?
So we're definitely aiming towards being able to start creating our own content as well. That is a goal for the studio, and to have internal artists, like our full-time employees, such as like Jess as well, to be able to, if she wants, to pitch a project, and then we could potentially pick that up and develop a pitch or a teaser or pilot or something like that, depending on what the project is. So that is definitely a goal for us and a vision, because most of us got into it with the idea of creating either art or stories, and we really want to sort of foster that and still encourage that, so it doesn't just become service work. And I think animation is this sort of weird mix of you go into it with some sort of passion, but then it's a lot of hard work, and it becomes this weird mix of passion versus factory work sometimes even. And you need to be very like disciplined and work in a certain way. Folder structure and formats and Excel sheets and all that stuff becomes part of the daily life as well, even when you just want to draw.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes an advertisement comes along that means you can actually put a bit of your love of Ghibli maybe into the advert as well, right? Tell us about the advert for Oregon and the what little Easter eggs might people find in there.
I mean, I think the whole film is just one big Easter egg. It's probably fair to say. I mean, it was very much from the client as well, saying that they wanted that Ghibli feel, that they wanted that to really to feel like a Ghibli film when you watch it, to sort of Ghiblify Oregon. But that was just like a gift for us as a studio, because we love that style as well. To really like dive into it and say like, okay, what does actually make his style? I remember looking at like how you shade the character, or how they do the shadows on the characters, which is mostly these like very rounded shapes. So everything feels very like soft, and like clothes are like, there's very rarely like a hard edge on outfits and stuff. Everything feels pretty rounded. But only to a certain level, because it doesn't become cartoony either. So there's like very like specific details looking into that, which is just a gift for animation nerds like us to be paid to sit and look into like one frame. And I remember our art director Simon Lee at that point also really studying the backgrounds and looking at painting processes from Ghibli, seeing how you would use these like poster paints to paint the backgrounds on these giant canvases where everyone's drooling watching it. So it was amazing to sit and just try and copy that style. And then, of course, it's very humbling as well, because then when you see it, you're like, we're all kind of there, but like you can never become like a master.
Well, I mean, at the current rate, like they're rumored to be taking, making 2 minutes worth of film every month on the new Miyazaki film. So, I mean, send them this and say, guys, if you need some extra help, like we send us an email. Here's our job application. All right. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about with Flea and Ghibli, but we've reached the point of the conversation where we need to know where we need to travel to next, because we've spoken about Ghibli on this podcast. We've spoken about, we just mentioned Cartoon Saloon, and we are always looking for other people that we should be studying. So where do you guys think the Ghibli tech should be migrating to next? Jess?
Oh, on the spot. when you mentioned that at the beginning, I was like, I'm going to think about this, and then promptly forgot about it. I think I like, this is terrible to admit, but I don't watch that much animation anymore. And I know a lot of animators who say the same thing, and I think it's because out of like a way to not be self-referential with some of the stuff, because there's not that much animation that comes out every year, I guess, at the end of the day. The stuff that I do watch, I'm always like, this is amazing. But I think a lot of my influences come from like live action.
Feel free to suggest live action. We've had live action suggestions in the past. So,
well, I mean, one of the curators of the Miyazaki exhibition said, "Do Celine Sciamma." So
it's like cool. Yeah. I think like when I graduated like at the school over here in Denmark, Ken and I went to the same uni. That's kind of how we originally met, very vaguely. When I did my graduation film with some friends, one of our like that was a film that was based on the tsunami in Japan in 2011. So a lot of the like references were coming from Japanese life, and so we looked at Ghibli a lot. But I remember that we looked a lot at Yasujirō Ozu, who may have been mentioned before. I don't know, but I think that that's a really good reference for like the. Like I think there's a lot of the same spirit in that those films as there is in Ghibli films, and a lot of these like little mood moments and small details that like make a character. I think it's something that relates pretty closely. I'll look at that.
He's got a long filmography.
Yeah, I mean, I really like late autumn. I think it's late spring that everyone says.
Yeah,
it's either that or it's the other way around. I can't remember. There's one that's really famous, and it's the other one.
What about you, Kenneth?
I think for animation, I would say Masaki Yuasa. I don't know if he has been recommended before, but I love his stuff. I want to birth his children, as they say. I watched Tatami Galaxy, I think it's called, the series, which is just amazing. So I can highly recommend that and Ping Pong from him. But just anything he does, basically, just watch it and you'll be in for a treat.
He's the classic example of an animator who couldn't stick to model, so they bumped him over to storyboards instead of an in-betweener quite early on. His stuff is so fluid and wonderful.
Yes, and it just goes like so many crazy places, but it still sticks within the sort of like the experience of the story and the experience of the world. But it's just absolute creativity and just goes wild, and I love it. And I think like Tatami Galaxy and Ping Pong are two examples where that sort of craziness and wildness still stays within a pretty sort of cohesive story, or like a narrative you can actually like follow without it getting too abstract. Although I love like Mind Game and these other movies where it goes completely crazy. Then I can really recommend those two series as well. He also did one, has a weird name. It's like Hands Off Isaacin, I think it's called, which actually I watched it and it's actually really, really explains the animation process really, really well. There's even a show where like an episode where they run out of budget and then they are like, how do we save time? And then they go through like different tricks in animation of having just one drawing that you're sort of moving the camera around to make it look more dramatic. that one I can highly recommend. And then live action, I would say Lynn Ramsey. She's really, really cool. I love her as well. I would love to work with her one day, but it's probably not going to happen.
I mean, she just made a documentary. Who knows what she might do next? Yeah. She wants to do an animated one. She knows who to call.
I would be ready. I would work for free for her.
Don't say that.
can you cut that out?
Yeah, won't look good on the spreadsheet.
If you record yourself saying, you know, my normal rate, and we'll paste that in. Amazing recommendations. Thank you so much. Oh, it's been such a treat speaking with both of you, Jess and Kenneth. Thank you for joining us and talking Flea and Ghibli. It's been a treat. Thank you to Kenneth and Jess for speaking with us and tackling all our ignorant, nerdy questions, not having an artistic bone in our bodies. That was such a treat. Thank you so much. And please go and watch Flea if you haven't already.
Absolutely. And we've still got a lot more to come on the chat bus. So many more conversations to get a bit too nerdy about Studio Ghibli. Next time, we are talking to the co-writer of what is already one of the best films of the year, Michael.
Oh, I definitely say so. And also one of the biggest Studio Ghibli and anime tributes of the year is Pixar's Turning Red that premiered on Disney Plus earlier this year. An instant favourite for our team, I think.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And so we're very, very lucky to have Julia Cho, who wrote it alongside Domi Shi, coming on the podcast to get into her Ghibli roots. Someone with an incredibly unique trajectory for getting into Studio Ghibli, and I'd love it if there's anyone else that has somehow mimicked that as well. So a bit of a tease for you there. And if you haven't heard it already, we actually had Domi Shi on the podcast way back in the early days of the pandemic. She was kind enough to Zoom us where she was remotely directing a film, which sounds like an absolute nightmare. But she was willing to give us an hour or so to chat about her Ghibli origin story too, which was lovely. So definitely check back in our feed and listen to that episode.
But that's next episode. For now, that's it from us. Before we go, please do sign up to our Patreon if you haven't already. We've got all sorts of fun stuff happening in the Discord already, as well as the Library Cafe episodes that's going live. We had our take at length on the Batman. We also had an episode very recently about Turning Red, which of course is the film we're going to be talking about in the next episode. Until then, you can also catch us on socials too. We're at Ghibli Attack on Twitter, ghibliattack.pod. On Instagram, you can follow Steph at _StephWatts and Jake at JakeHCunningham.
And you can follow Michael at MichaelJLeader.
Ghibliotech is produced by Michael Leader, Jake Cunningham, Harold McShill, and Steph Watts. Our music is by Anthony Ng. Thank you.
even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.